You're listening to Advancing Our Church.
Relationship is an essential component to our contact with others and our partnership with them. I think for our men, we need to gear them much more toward a much more simple life. And I think as Pope Francis, one of the first things that he did was to live a more simple life. And my parents were just as supportive of my brothers and sisters getting married as they were for the two of us becoming priests. It was just something very normal.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I hope you had a terrific week. I'm Jim Friend, and welcome to Advancing Our Church, Episode 4. It's been an exciting couple weeks watching the audience of our podcast grow, and I just want to thank all of you for your prayers and support, and a very special welcome to any of our new listeners. I received some great feedback on the St. James alumni interview last week, and some nice shout-outs from my friends in the Catholic education community. Retweeting and reposting us on social media is always a huge help and very much appreciated, so thank you for your support. Next week, we'll be returning to the topic of Catholic education when I interview my friends at Berks Catholic High School in my home diocese of Allentown. It's a huge success story that was featured in Momentum magazine a couple of years ago on the merger of two Catholic high schools. Tune in to hear the story of how they merged and grew enrollment at the new high school, which is now larger than the two previous high schools combined. It's an inspiring story, and I hope you'll join us. Well, with all that housekeeping aside, now let's get to work. St. John Vianney said, "The priest is not a priest for himself. He is a priest for you." He also said, "The priesthood is the love of the heart of Jesus. When you see a priest, think of our Lord Jesus Christ." Our guest today exemplifies these words. Meet Monsignor Andrew Baker, the rector of the seminary and vice president of Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Monsignor Baker was ordained to the priesthood in the Diocese of Allentown in 1991. He has served in a variety of parishes, including pastor of the Cathedral of St. Catherine of Siena in the Diocese of Allentown. Monsignor Baker has taught on high school faculties and served as a Catholic University chaplain. Monsignor Baker has served on the faculty of St. Charles Seminary in Overbrook and on the Congregation for Bishops in Rome. He earned a license in sacred theology from the University of Navarre and a doctorate from the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross in Rome. I worked with Monsignor Baker just a few years ago when we both served in the Diocese of Allentown, and I was very pleased that he invited me to visit him at the Mount while I was in Maryland last month. My interview took place in Monsignor's office, and ironically, as I walked in, he pointed out that he was catching up on his home diocese by reading the latest copy of the 80 Times. Monsignor Baker is just an incredibly smart, dedicated, and holy man. And I think as you listen to our conversation about his role as rector of the seminary, you'll learn, as I did, about the complexities of running a national seminary and how important it is to build relationships. While I sat with him, I also asked him towards the end of my interview how he managed to run a successful debt reduction campaign while he was pastor of the cathedral in Allentown. Stick around for that part of the story because Monsignor offers some great thoughts on his role as pastor, which can be applied to any leader who is thinking about a fundraising campaign. Without further ado, here is my interview with Monsignor Baker.
Maybe we could start with, tell me a little bit about the history of the seminary here.
It's got a long history, 1808.
Okay.
So it was the second oldest seminary in the country. It was founded by Father John Dubois, who became the fourth bishop of New York. So it's steeped in history. And in 1808, Father Dubois, who was a French immigrant, saw the need to educate younger boys to prepare them for the major seminary, the theologate, if you will. And the only one in the country was St. Mary's in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So he devised this seminary to be a feeder school, if you will, to prepare the younger boys with basic education so that they could go on and study theology. And from that grew a theologate, which is that last 4 years of theology before ordination, and a university that grew out of that as well.
And it's a beautiful campus.
It's really incredible. He knew exactly what he was doing when he came here. And this mountain, as a matter of fact, was called, even before he arrived here, St. Mary's Mount. So the seminary became known as Mount St. Mary's, and then right. University, Mount St. Mary's University. But even the locals, the Catholics that were here, and there's been a long tradition of Catholics being in this area, saw this as a very special place. So since that time, I mean, we've educated thousands and thousands of priests. Included among them are 51 bishops over our history.
Oh, wonderful.
And that kind of makes sense because in the beginning there were only two seminaries, so they had to come from somewhere. But right now we are serving 21 partner dioceses. We're also serving four congregations of religious life or consecrated life. And we have 117 seminarians. So that would include 2 years of pre-theology, and they're basically studying their philosophy, and then 4 years of theology after that up until they're both diaconate and then finally priesthood ordination at the end. So it's a great, both historic place. We're one of the largest seminaries in the country. And we're not just a regional seminary. We're really national in scope. So we have men from Colorado. Mm-hmm. We have men from Georgia. We have men from Kansas, from Nebraska, from Wisconsin. And then all the locals here, Washington, D.C., Arlington, Virginia, Harrisburg, just north of here. So we get them from all over. And it's a wonderful mixture of really good men, and they're going to make great priests.
That's wonderful. And why would, so if you have, how many partner dioceses did you say?
21 partner
21.
Dioceses.
So right. If a young man was interested from that particular diocese, he would naturally come here, right? Or would he?
Well, if he's in that diocese, most of our dioceses also send or partner with one other, if not more, seminaries.
Gotcha.
So normally the decision to go to this seminary, to the Mount, is up to the bishop or vocation director. Some dioceses ask for an input from the seminarian, but normally it's not the seminarian himself who decides. So what makes it kind of unusual, for instance, in a school setting, you're really trying to attract, to one degree, parents, but later on, high school, and then also certainly at university level, you're trying to attract the student, him or herself, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we're all about attracting vocation directors and bishops, because the seminarians, while they sometimes come and visit, it's ultimately the decision of the bishop or vocation director. So that makes our approach a little bit different. If you can put it that way, our marketing is targeted not so much at the seminarian himself, although it's all about him.
Sure.
And our mission here is seminarian-centered, mm-hmm. and the seminarian is really our best promoter. By how well that we help serve, we serve him, that gets the word out. But so that's one way. That's kind of our best billboard, I say, is our seminarian himself. But when we're trying to kind of get other seminarians, if I go to a bishop and he's convinced that, oh, the Mount would be a great place to send, he's not just sending usually one, he'll send a couple. And then over the years, he'll continue to try to, send and seminarians and partner with us continually. So our target is sometimes more toward bishop and vocation director than seminarian himself.
Mm-hmm. So consequently, do you go out and see those bishops and seminary directors, or do they come here to the Mount?
A mixture of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I go out and I have visited some dioceses in the Midwest where we partner with them, and then also a bishop that we don't. This coming week, I'm going out to a diocese to meet with a bishop who hasn't sent. He's a relatively new bishop, and it's been a long time since they have sent here. Then also we have those that we do partner with, they come in and visit. So the vocation director at least visits once, if not twice a year. And they'll come and stay a day or two or sometimes three. We'll meet with the vocation director. We have sometimes rather long meetings depending on how many seminarians they have here. And we go through the whole process of how well his seminarian is doing. And we go through each one individually. And then he also has an opportunity to meet us, meet the faculty, meet the other seminarians. We had a bishop here a couple of weeks ago with whom we met, and as you might remember, the Mount basketball team was very successful this year, mm-hmm. and actually played Villanova. Excuse me. So he went down and watched the basketball game with the guys down in our rec room. So they get an opportunity to kind of visit, and we have that kind of personal contact, because that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
I remember Bishop Cullen once telling me, he said, it's all about relationships.
Yeah.
And when it, push comes to shove, it's more than just about numbers and structures and programs. Fundamentally, it's a relationship, because that is our faith, too. God himself is a relationship, mm-hmm. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Our lives were meant to be relational. And so for the seminary in a particular way, relationship is an essential component to our contact with others and our partnership with them.
That's wonderful.
So you mentioned you had some young men preparing for religious life as well as diocesan life.
Right.
How is their formation differentiated here at the seminary?
Yeah. Well, they, three of the four congregations for consecrated life have their own kind of house, if you will. They're living in somewhat of a community. So they come here for much of the day, but they also have contact with and live with their formators too, so that they can grow in their own spirit, their own charism, and get a chance to live in community. We also have some oratorians, which is a kind of a hybrid, if you will. They are eventually they will become priests for a particular diocese, but they follow a particular rule of life, that of St. Philip Neri. So they too will have contact with their communities, whether it's a visit here or one of them actually, or both of them, return to their houses in their diocese for their pastoral field education. It's a little bit long way for both of them, and sometimes they only go every other week, but they sometimes spend the entire weekend with their communities and then come back for the week. So we still have that ability for religious congregations to have a way in which their formation continues as a religious, but at the same time, we also help them with their education, with their living of their spiritual life and their liturgical life, and our formation advising is all here, localized at the seminary. Mm-hmm.
Do you, being the rector, I imagine you do you work with a lot of different folks. Do you get to individually spend a lot of time with the men here at the seminary?
I do, and I wish it was more.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's always the challenge.
Yeah,
because it is also an administrative position, both at the university level. I'm a vice president of the university, and certainly here at the seminary, there's a lot of, if you will, administrative work that needs to be done, a lot of meetings. And but since I live here, I eat here, I pray here. I'm thankfully embedded in the life of the seminary. It is somewhat of a family, so I wish I could spend even more time with the guys.
Sure.
But the opportunity is always here. This is it's our home. Whenever I talk to the university, they note that, you know, the students that come, it's homely, but they've got a home to go to. But here at the seminary, it's much more of a home for us, especially the priests, because we live here all the time.
Yeah.
We have no other place to go to. This is our home.
So what would you say to a young man who is thinking about a life of a priest? Yeah. What kind of an interview process do you have?
Yeah. Well, primarily if they're thinking of it, their first kind of interview and contact is with their own home diocese.
Okay.
So if they've come to the point where, especially through help of another priest or even their family members or teachers, and they're kind of discerning a vocation, their first step is with kind of the local church. Often it's the pastor or the vocation director, but eventually it would have to be the vocation director of that diocese and then the bishop. So there's usually a process by which they go through an interview process, and the vocation director principally gets to know the young man over a period of time and activities and interviews as well, and then the bishop to some extent. And then they decide if they're going to send them here. Then sometimes they'll come and visit here. If the bishop says, I'm thinking of sending you there, go and check it out. So I will meet with them just in a very informal way. They'll have an opportunity to participate in the life of the seminary. Some of them will attend classes with seminarians from that diocese from which they come. They'll be here and participating in Mass. Some of the fun things that the guys do, they'll be a part of that. Just to help them see a little bit more about seminary life, and particularly how that is here at Mount St. Mary's. Some I don't see, or we don't interview. Sometimes the diocese basically goes through the whole process and sends the paperwork, and then we say, from what we see, we'd love to have him, and then we meet him on the first day. So it's really kind of mixed how we do it.
That's great. From your vantage point, having all these contacts with different dioceses, you must see a lot of different kinds of marketing programs for seminarians. What are some of the ones, some of the better ones that you've seen, or more effective ones?
Yeah, you know, short, brief videos.
Okay.
That seems to be extremely effective in today's world, I think. Something really eye-catching, that's inspiring, and that's not too long. And the same I would say about materials, too.
something that's very clear, eye-catching, not too long. For young people and even for very busy vocation directors and bishops, that's, they just don't have they don't think they have the time, and they want to kind of get what they can almost immediately. We're living in that world, for good or for evil, of immediate eye-catching, information flowing,
sure,
kind of world. So, but then secondly, I would say not to fall into the trap of relying on print or video on media, because I really think in this kind of world, if you will, the world of seminaries, that personal approach is becoming more important and more noticeable. You stand out if you pick up the phone and call a vocation director, for instance, and they've said that to me. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the fact that you took the time to call me. When I visited some of the bishops, they were very grateful. Well, it's nice that you came here. You know, that kind of personal contact can go a long way, and it's more noticeable, I think, now in today's world than ever before, that real personal contact, because it's just not as done in a lot of other areas of their lives.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
good. I have certainly seen too. We host here at the seminary during the summer months what we call the Quo Vadis camps, the vocational camps, and that helps two, I think, areas of our life here. One is it helps the diocese that's coming. So if we have a partner diocese that says, we'd like to come during the summer and have our vocation camp at your seminary, well, that's helping them. That's a good thing. But it also promotes the seminary.
Sure.
Because those young men are thinking, I could come here. I think that's a great promotion as well, just to show the place and to make it available to young men that are thinking about it. They also have, some of these dioceses also bring what they call their fiat camps, where they're girls, young girls, that are thinking of religious life. Mm-hmm. Once again, it helps with our partner dioceses. You know, we're helping them out in their own vocations, the numbers. But also, it helps promote this particular institution, because people see the beauty of it. They begin to think, I could be here. I could see myself here at Mount St. Mary's Seminary.
Tell me a little bit about, kind of your vision for the seminary. You've been here 2 years now?
Almost two years.
I imagine there was a little bit of a honeymoon factor where you had to get, understand the history and kind of what you wanted to bring to the table. But now you're finishing up your second year. What kind of focus do you have? And what kind of culture do you promote here at the seminary?
Yeah. Well, one of the first rector's conference that I gave, I called it being Francis-esque, to try to bring, I think, the great qualities that we see in Pope Francis, and also the things that he's beginning to say about formation of priests, to the forefront in our formation program here. For instance, simplicity of life. I'd really like to, we live in such a materialistic age, and young people today have got sometimes more than enough, if you will, maybe too much in things, in choices, in even just material wealth. I think for our men, we need to gear them much more toward a much more simple life. And I think as Pope Francis, one of the first things that he did was to live a more simple life in that residence, the Santa Marta, rather than the Papal Palace. That was just a clear sign to me that needs to be, that's great for our age, and it's something that's very important in our society. Also, he has spoken a lot about the church. I should say he's used this phrase several times, but I think in many ways he's spoken about the church being that field hospital. So part of our job as formators is to help our men understand that the world in which we live isn't perfect. It is a battlefield. But that doesn't mean we should avoid the battle or avoid people that are beaten up and battled and having difficulties. And no, as individuals, as priests, and therefore we bring the church to the battlefield to be a place of mercy, to be a place of kindness, to be a place of healing. And we can't do that by sitting back and waiting. We have to be that field hospital, advance. Also, one program that was here at the seminary that I've been promoting a little bit more and want to see more of is what we call the Evangelization Mission Trip. It was started by a group of seminarians a number of years ago, and I've asked that our men participate in it at least once while they're here in formation, so it becomes a requirement of formation. Every fall and spring break, a group of our seminarians, 20 to 30 or so, partner with a campus, college campus. Could be Catholic, maybe not. The last one they went to was Towson University, close to here, and it's not a Catholic university. George Mason, we went in the fall, not Catholic. Be Catholic or not. And they work with the chaplain there, as well as if there are focused missionaries, the Fellowship of Catholic University students. If there are those Catholic missionaries on campus, they also work with them. And they do basically street evangelization. Once again, we have to be willing to engage people, engage culture, engage the questions that arise in people's lives. And the men come back thinking, you know, I need to study more philosophy before theology, because people's questions are very basic. Is there even good in this world? What's the meaning of suffering? Does God exist? And those are real basic questions that they get into conversations with college students and some even faculty and staff. And they're on the sidewalk, two by two, meeting people, saying, how are you? My name is, what's your life like? What's your major? And with that, a whole conversation starts. So those are the kinds of things that I think formation needs to be doing a bit more of, and is part of that Francis-esque culture, if you will, within the seminary. And then finally, I would say that this whole, what I would call theology of accompaniment, I think is very important. Pope Francis has certainly used that word, and it's a word that's recurring over and over again in the new guidelines that just came out in the fall for seminary formation. These guidelines right now are at the universal level of the church, and then the bishops here in the United States are going to take those guidelines and make more specific ones for the United States. But this document that came out uses that word accompaniment many, many times. And I think it's going to help, it really has to help change us as formators to realize that we're not to simply be teachers bestowing some sort of information to them. We have to, along with the seminarians, accompany them in their discernment of the vocations and help them make a decision. And a decision that they are very clear about, they know what they're doing, and they make it in a permanent way. Because after ordination, as it is with marriage, you've got to be ready to make that decision and then be willing to follow through with it. But that takes an accompaniment with and getting to know the seminarian well in order to make that happen.
Yeah. So. Wow. You've mentioned Pope Francis quite a bit, and do you? He's such an inspiring figure in our church. Are you finding that that these men are, many of them must be inspired by his life and his example? Are you finding that bringing more men to the priesthood today?
I think probably not as much. There'd be certainly some qualities that they do admire and want to follow. So I think to the degree that it really helps them in their kind of character building, I think that's probably the case. But their reasons for coming to the priesthood and discerning their vocation usually has something to do with a local person in question. You know, it's kind of interesting. Even though the Pope certainly is inspiring, and all the popes have been in their own way, and sometimes they can cause a young man, and they do, to think a little bit more deeply. But when you start talking to them about their vocation, they start talking about the events in their lives, or the priest that they met, or the college where they were, and how they received kind of a reversion in their faith. And it's more of a, if you will, local reasons for coming forward and recognizing that maybe God's calling me to be a priest.
Personal reasons,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah. Personal and personal story. And, mm-hmm. Just last night we had a dinner for our benefactors. Very successful dinner for our benefactors. And what do they love the most? We did several things leading up to the dinner and at the dinner itself. But we had two of our seminarians give their vocation story. And I said this publicly, it's very easy to promote the seminary. As rector, all I have to do is get out of the way and get these seminarians up here and just tell their story. This is who you're supporting. This is why you're supporting it. This is how they got here. And they are going to be priests for God's people, but they're going to be priests also because of God's people.
because of their support, prayerfully and financially. And so again, I don't have to, I just have to get out of the way and let the seminarians speak. Because again, their vocation story is very, you know, it's their personal history. And God has spoken to them in that personal history.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your benefactors. That's probably a big part of your job, or is it fundraising for the seminary?
Yes, to some degree. We have a director of seminary development that works with the university advancement team, and plus an administrative assistant. So those two ladies are just wonderful. They work great as a team. So they're doing a little bit of that fundraising, but as rector, I'm also part of that kind of team. So yeah, it's actually a little more than I would have thought. I'm doing more of that kind of fundraising than I originally would have thought, but it's fine.
And is your donor base kind of a national base, or are they a lot of them localized here?
Well, the majority would be here. Certainly our alumni is national, so we have those. Some of our bigger lay donors would be more local here. Some of them had been involved with the university or a seminary. But we do have some very generous parents of both seminarians and priests that are found around the world. But probably, you know, our biggest ones, and if we really put them all together, they'd be within that kind of tri-state, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, D.C. area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. What can we do as laity, as parents, to encourage vocations?
Yeah. I speaking about personal story.
Yeah.
I can go back to my own personal story.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say that what can people do? If you are living your faith to its fullest degree and through thick and thin, that are helping your children to both know the faith, to know Jesus Christ, to help them to develop a real prayer life, to give them a good education, I would recommend Catholic education, absolutely. Just giving them that will be an incredible encouragement, because then they'll have the tools, if you will, to discern, and that's when God will speak and they'll recognize His voice. So that's the first thing. Secondly, in my experience with the seminarians, for the most part, parents are supportive, but not always, and that makes a big difference. So if you notice something within a child, you know, your young son or daughter, and you think it might be a vocation, encouraging that explicitly without being, you know, in any way oppressive, but just giving them an opportunity to voice it and to encourage it, and maybe go to a Quo Vadis or Fiat, or make it normal. If that was their choice, as any other choice would be, it'd be just as normal, and you would be just as supportive. Because I know, coming from a large family, I have 11 brothers and sisters. There's two of us that are priests, and many of them are married. And my parents were just as supportive of my brothers and sisters getting married as they were for the two of us becoming priests. It was just something very normal. That's certainly would be a little bit of advice. And then pray. Prayer, especially the rosary, for vocations and in front of the Blessed Sacrament. It sounds just very basic, but it's true. In one of my previous assignments, I had the opportunity to look over what they call quinquennial reports from dioceses. So every 5 years or so, a bishop has to put a report together and report to Rome, to the Holy Father, about what's going on in the diocese. And almost in every case that I saw an increase of vocations, a noticeable increase of vocations, there was also at the same time an increase in Eucharistic adoration in that diocese. Whether it was more parishes doing 24 hours or just a little bit more Eucharistic adoration for some hours, it was almost eerie the way those two things happened at almost the same time. And everybody can do that. That's something that's at the heart of what it means to be a saint, mm-hmm. laity and clergy alike.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the team here at the seminary, the folks that you work with.
Yeah. Well, they're very experienced. Mm-hmm. And they're all centered on formation. They want to be here because they want to serve the church. And they believe in the mission of the seminary. One good thing about the seminary is that our mission is very focused. We are about priestly formation. It's almost, you can't help but know that. You know, you go to another university or another business, and There can actually be competing, if you will, missions, but here it's pretty focused and clear. And that helps because we've got committed people to say, I'm here because of that mission. It's not just simply a job, it's a love for them. And when I came on board, there were a lot of very experienced, both formators and administrators and staff. But I must say that, but as a team, it's clearly focused. It's also family oriented, which I didn't expect, particularly among the faculty and staff. So that we'll have events here at the seminary, and the families will participate. Professor and spouse and children. So down in our rec room, you know, for a Christmas party, you know, or whatever, the kids are also kind of a part of our life and the life of the seminarians. It's going to be very interesting, as one professor said to me, when his daughter grows up, you know, she's only six or so, but what she's going to say about the seminary, because she knew these guys, and she's going to know them all growing up, and she had been here. This is like a somewhat of a second home for her. You know, Daddy works for the seminary, and she's here. So there's a real family orientation to this place, which is good, because I think that's good for the men in their formation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was your work in Allentown when you were the pastor of the cathedral there. You ran a debt reduction campaign, which was very, very successful.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of pastors who may face the same kind of challenges in their own parish, it's certainly an inspirational story, at least it is to me. Can you tell me a little bit about that whole process that led you to decide to do that campaign, and maybe just a little bit about the project itself?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was warned ahead of time that this is the worst kind of campaign that anybody can do, debt reduction.
Absolutely, you know? So yes.
Why are you doing that?
That's why it was so inspiring.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a risk. You can't be afraid to take risks, because for a parish that was kind of changing a bit demographically, when I first became pastor, I clearly saw that we needed to plan for the future. And part of that future was we could no longer be weighed down by this debt. It was taking away from the essential mission of the church. We didn't have dollars to do things that we needed to do.
And it was about $1 million, as I
It was $1.7 million when
million
I first arrived.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and just in debt. So we weren't even paying, you know, the interest on that, and getting worse. And so, you know, the first thing that I needed to do was to think and pray about it, and then talk to people about it. Talk to the parish, talk to the parish council, the finance council. And at first, you know, the advice came back, you can't just do debt reduction, because that's, no one's going to like that. I mean, people aren't going to contribute to that. It's the worst thing you could do. Who's going to, you know? So we thought, well, maybe we'll kind of spice it up a little bit and maybe do a little project and also reduce the debt. And at a certain point in one of the meetings that I had, one of the parishioners just said, you know what, Monsignor, just do it. We all know how bad this is. It's weighing us down. We can't get through this. Let's just be honest with the rest of the parishioners and say, we got to get rid of this debt. And they'll respond if you're just honest with them. So I thought, all right, let's do it. And it made people, I think, that I had to communicate the clarity of why this was important to get rid of. I said, it's like, well, we're not building bricks, but every bit of money that comes, you're not only giving a dollar to it, but because it's reducing also the, you know, we're reducing the principal, but we're also reducing our interest payments. So every dollar was, I don't know, $1.06 or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're actually giving more than you actually give. And that those bricks, while are not physical, they're bricks that we'll be able to, or things that we're able to do once we're relieved of this weight. So while it doesn't, we're not building anything and you can't see anything, it's really building for the future. It's building for you and your children and your grandchildren. Taking this away will make us much more stable and able to do what we need to do for our mission. So it was just, I think, just constantly letting people know of the situation that we're in, that we needed to plan for the future and give people that hope. And once you do that, you're clear in your communication, and you provide some hope for people, they'll come on board. They will. But you got to give them the hope, and you got to give them the clarity that they need. And then finally, I would say this, and I learned this in the process. It was the first time I had become a pastor. I've been in the parish before, but only as the assistant. And there's a difference. You suddenly are, you know, the buck stops there, and you're the father of the family. So I learned that with campaigns, with raising money, the first thing a priest needs to do is to serve his people well. If you're serving them well, and you come back to them and say, "We need this," they'll say, "All right, I trust you. I see that you're serving us well, and the parish will be the same, serving us well." But you've got to serve the people well, no matter what situation you're in, because that just builds then some confidence and gives them hope too, that they are being served well by their priests. So I tried to also do that as soon as I could, to build up a good, strong relationship, to build up the trust, and to help them to realize that, you know, why are we doing all this is so that the parish can serve you, and that you'll have priests in the future to serve you as well.
It's wonderful. It's a great story. And how much did you raise in the end?
It was 1.2, I think, in the end.
1.2.
1.2 out of the one. We had gotten it down to 1.6, I think, before the campaign even started. Mm-hmm. And then it was at least 1.2. Mm-hmm. Lowering our interest and then making it possible for them to, not only to pay the interest, but also pay into the principal slowly. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure where it is now, but it certainly was a great relief.
Absolutely. And while you were there, a couple of other development type things you did was implement stewardship as a way of life at your parish, and began a legacy society as well, right?
Exactly.
The Siena Society.
The Siena Society, precisely, yeah.
Yeah, and did you find that people embraced stewardship right away, or did it take time to help them understand that it was not just about the treasure, but that it was time and talent. As well?
Yeah, it takes time. I think that's the biggest challenge, that stewardship to be promoted as time, treasure, and talent. And for people to see that, you know, stewardship is not just simply coming out of one's wallet. It's got to come out of one's heart. And it has to be a commitment to their faith, to their church, their local community, and a personal commitment. It involves sacrifice, yes, but it's that personal commitment, and that takes time. I think, unfortunately, too many Catholics, giving to the parish, if you will, is just money. And it's usually the extra change in their back pocket. And it's been the same amount for, you know, 20 years. But rather to see stewardship from a biblical perspective, you know. It is a way of life, if you will. A way of truly participating, giving. And it's giving back ultimately to God himself, who we owe everything to.
Yeah, absolutely. And then lastly, tell me a little bit about the Siena Society, how you got it started, and a little bit of that.
Well, I saw that there were a lot of really good people, and at an age in which they thought they really wanted to support the parish in an ongoing way. So in part, it was a response to those people, but also thinking of the future, too, which brings hope, once again. So the Siena Society was a way in which people could leave a legacy, something behind, an act of love for the future. So we organized it in such a way that people could give to it and be a part of it at whatever level and in many different ways. It was integrated, as you know, with a Diocesan Legacy Society too. And then we gave back too with prayers, continual prayer, and then events. We had a couple of events for Siena Society, both members and other people that might be interested in it. It's kind of an ongoing formation and activity, it's an investment in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Anything else you want to add?
Here at the Mount, I guess the stewardship is a bit unique, mm-hmm. in the sense that we have priests. I'm not usually dealing with priests as far as stewardship is concerned. But there are priests, too, who want to see formation continuing. They also want to be invested in their parishes, maybe not at the same level. But I've really admired a number of the priest alumni that have kind of come forward and either left things for the seminary and are interested in keeping this place going. There's a great pride, a good pride. So whether it's a school or a seminary like ours, that relationship with alumni is really critical.
it's not something that I fully realized as a pastor so much. We did have a school, but that alumni connection to where they had gone, where they had been formed, where they received an education, a moment in their life that was so critical, reconnecting with them and showing that what they had can continue is just an important part of, I think, stewardship in an institution like this, or especially a school or university.
What kind of a lot of these young men will go on one day and be a pastor at a parish. Is that a part of their priestly formation, to be a shepherd for a community and understand all the different dynamics?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It certainly is. And we know that some of these men will go back to diocese, and within 2 or 3 years, sometimes they'll be a pastor.
Wow,
and sometimes it's very quick,
yeah,
extremely quick. And we've had some of the alumni come back and say that. Yeah, they're now pastors in just a couple of years, depending on the diocese and the situation. And some of them will be pastors of several parishes. They might be smaller at first, but it'll happen sooner rather than later. So we're getting them, we have to get them ready right away to be a pastor. One of the things that we do beyond the academic is that we have something called Pastors and Stewards. We've developed a program with the help of Lily, Grant, of computer modules that the seminarians can do while they're here. Modules such as personal finances, 2 modules on parish finances, on human resources, there's one on leadership. So these are things that we help them with when they're here, right? They go through it. And then when they become pastors, they can just log back in and see, now, what did a budget look like again? What was the parish budget? What are these things in the parish budget again? And just review that. Because some of those more practical things those are things that they have to know right away.
Right.
No matter how small the parish is, a couple of years out, they're going to be the pastor, and they have to have some knowledge of what's necessary. So our aim here is, all right, guys, you're going to be pastors. For the most part, right? You're parish priests for the most part. You're going to be pastors, and for a long part of your priestly life. So we want to get you ready now.
Yeah. How is formation? Or when were you ordained?
What year? 1991.
So how has it evolved since you were ordained in 1991?
Yeah, I'm constantly asking myself that question because I see it all the time.
Yeah.
How in the world? I think, first of all, just going back to that point about being named pastor, when I was ordained in 1991, I thought I'd be a pastor when I was 20, 25 years ordained. That would not have been, in Allentown even at that time, would not have been that unusual. I mean, that probably was about right. Now, quickly, within my time, even though because of various assignments, I was probably ordained 16 years or so, 16, no, maybe 17 years when I became a pastor. Although priests of my time were named pastors much younger than that, so that changed very quickly. The amount of years for priests being appointed pastors dropped dramatically right after I was ordained. So that's one of the things that we've got to make sure that we do well here. The second thing that's very different than it was even when I was ordained was that priests aren't living together with other priests anymore. When I was ordained, it was not unusual to have 2 or 3 in a parish, and maybe 1 or 2 had 4. That's not the case. I became an assistant pastor, there was another assistant pastor, and the pastor. There was 3 of us. It wasn't an unusual set of circumstances. Now, we have to prepare our men to be ready to be living on their own very quickly. They might have a couple of years with a pastor, but soon they're going to have to live on their own. That's why they're spiritual lives and their prayer life has got to be real solid and strong so they can deal with all these kinds of changing pressures and a changing world. And they need to develop a stronger, even more so, a stronger fraternity among them so that they can have the strength of their brothers when they get in these kinds of isolated positions and places. Also, the human formation of seminarians is it wasn't even talked about when I was a seminarian. We talk about human formation. But since Pope John Paul II's apostolic exhortation called I Will Give Them Shepherds, Pastora Delva Vobis, since that time, which would have been 94 or so, there's been a greater emphasis on helping men in the seminary develop in character and in their humanity and virtue. As the church says in her documents, our humanity as priests should not be an obstacle but a bridge for others to encounter Christ. So that's changed since I was, you know, in the seminary. It was almost assumed that you had fairly decent character and you come from a good family, and you know, but that's not always the case. And so we need to emphasize more and more that character development, that human formation, than ever before. And then finally, I think the issues have changed. Some particular issues have changed too. When I was ordained, there were those hot button issues that were there. Primarily was abortion, but now we're talking about gender, we're talking about all these other things, and then they also have to deal with things that we never even thought of, the sexual abuse crisis, for instance, that really rubber hit the road there around 2002. That's something that we have to deal with as well, in their own kind of integration of sexuality, being aware of how they need to care for young adult children and young adults, and all those things that have to be in place, mm-hmm. For them to continue to care, and then also victims too. That's very important. The roads, they're going to have victims of abuse that they have to pastor and assist with, which would not have been even thought of when I was ordained. It just wasn't a reality as right. much. It was there. I shouldn't say that. It was a reality, but yeah. It just wasn't in any area of life or culture. It
was not. 2002 talked. Changed a lot.
It certainly did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these men have to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
This has been fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I want to thank Monsignor Baker for being on our show today. Monsignor, you are such an inspiring priest for all of us, and I'm sure especially the seminarians under your care. On behalf of all of us, thank you for working so hard to ensure the future of our church. And remember what Monsignor said, everyone, pray the rosary for vocations. What better month to start than in May, the month of Mary? For more information about Monsignor Baker and the seminary at Mount St. Mary's University, you can visit their website at msmary.edu/seminary. Well, that's our show this week. I want to thank you all for joining us for the fourth episode of Advancing Our Church. If you'd like more information about our show, please visit our website at advancingourchurch.com. Follow us on Twitter at Advance Podcast or join our Facebook group. If you'd like to support our show, give us a rating on iTunes or keep retweeting and reposting our show on social media. We sure appreciate it. I'm Jim Friend. I hope you all have a fantastic week. Take care, everybody, and God bless.